From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, W. Kamau Bell brings the CNN show The United Shades of America to Milwaukee.
Later, a Wisconsin writer shares the story of a pivotal moment in the gay rights movement.
There's been an oversimplification about Stonewall that says, you know, this was the spark that started the gay rights movement. And that's not really true. There had been a movement for decades before that. But Stonewall certainly was a catalyzing moment in turning what was a relatively small movement into a much larger one.
Then our sports contributor rates the Brewers season through the first 2 months.
And editor Carol Nixon shares Milwaukee Magazine's summer guide issue.
The fortunate thing is that there is so much to do in Milwaukee in the summer that we always find new things.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The CNN documentary series United Shades of America is nearing the end of its fourth season, and the second to last episode is all about Milwaukee.
The Emmy Award-winning series follows host W. Kamau Bell, a black stand-up comedian who travels across the country to where he says are places the audience may not expect him to go, places he's never been, or where he feels like he can learn something new.
Whether it's about the people who live in different cities or challenges specific to those areas, the show's goal is to inform the audience and to get them to think differently about what they thought they knew. Issues such as religion, racism, and white supremacy, for example, have been at the center of some of the episodes.
And it is a certain reputation in Milwaukee that brought Bell here. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell.
So Milwaukee's episode is called Hashtag Living While Black. How did Milwaukee get the honor of its own episode?
You know, we were talking about when we sit down to come up with a new season, I'm always trying to go to places and cities that, you know, a lot of classic American cities, I think it's important to go to those places, make sure we sort of hit all the big places on the map, and also go to places people wouldn't expect us to go or aren't thinking about. So it's sort of always like this, where haven't we been yet? And so Milwaukee is certainly a classic American city. And you go, okay, well, and then you go, okay, so then you also go, well, if we went to Milwaukee, sort of what's going on in Milwaukee? What's there to talk about? And one thing that comes up is like, regularly, Milwaukee, as you know, I'm sure, has been designated as the most segregated city in America. And so for our show, it's like, whoa, okay, that's right down our alley. I think that, like, the thing I was sort of aware of when we did that, though, is, like, we talk about racism all the time on our show. It's probably, I can't imagine an episode where we haven't talked about racism. But how do we approach that in a different way in this episode? And then also, how do I make sure that, because a lot of the show, people rely on me sitting in my seat going, like, what? I didn't know about any of this. Well, you know, due to how I was raised, I'm pretty conversant in segregation in America. My mom was from Indianapolis, was born in 1937. So then it becomes like, how do we book this show and create it in such a way that I'm not just sitting there going, yeah, I get all this. Even though the details, of course, I don't get because I'm not from Milwaukee. But I think that was the challenge of the show, and I'm really proud of how we did that. It's sort of like the conceit of like, okay, we're going to sort of pitch this one differently to the audience. This time, instead of me being the one who's sort of always sitting in the seat of not knowing, I'm going to assume that a big portion of our audience is and sort of going, welcome to the Black People meeting. And I have those kind of talks with my Black friends all the time where we just sort of get deep divey and sort of in the weeds about race in America and race and racism in America. And so I was like, that's how we're going to frame it. You get to come to the Black People meeting that I go to all the time. People out there who aren't Black, enjoy. As I say in the episode, white people, please don't bring the potato salad with the raisins in it.
Yes, I laughed at that one. So one of the topics that you got to in the episode was the many occurrences of white people calling the cops on Black people. And when you were intending to meet with Reggie Jackson, you just happened to be at the park where one of those instances were happening, and you ended up talking to Vaughn Mays, who is a community activist out here. What was it like for you actually having the chance to kind of witness that and be able to talk to the people who were out there?
I mean, it's sort of interesting with our show how often we sort of stumble into things that are about the thing we're talking about. Now, I mean, some of that is because we're heading to neighborhoods and parts of cities where those issues are already occurring, which is why we're going there. But that has happened more than once, where we sort of or we're in a place and somebody goes, well, if you go over here, you can see this thing. So at this point, I was sort of like, I think my reaction was like, are you serious? Is this actually happening? Like, you know, like, so like, I mean, to be in an episode that we'd already determined in the pitch, like, I was like, I want to use all these videos, all the barbecue Beckys of the world, and to sort of walk up on that thing, it was just like, it felt like, I guess for me, I just feel like the universe is going, you're on the right path. And luckily, honestly, the situation was not, nobody was hurt. Nobody was even that threatened by that woman. So it could have been a much worse situation. But luckily, because it was not, we were able to really sort of have fun with it. And if it had been different, we would have treated it differently, obviously. But, you know, for me, it was just like, and then to walk up on like one of the local tent poles of activism, because we're there to meet Reggie Jackson and meet Javon. It was just like, it was great because it got us an extra thing in the show that was super relevant and an extra conversation that we wouldn't have had otherwise, you know? So that's how I think the show works best, when we sort of follow our nose into whatever's happening. And when we pulled up and saw what's happening, I think you hear in the show, I was like, turn the cameras on, we got to go. Like, I was really like, yeah, we're basically shooting an episode of Cops for a second, you know? The cameras aren't aimed at the cops, they're aimed at the people who the cops are talking to.
And so, as I said, Reggie Jackson walked up kind of at that point, and you guys had like a back and forth. He was telling you about the historical kind of relationship between the Black community and the Milwaukee Police Department, and also the Sherman Park unrest that happened after the murder of Saville Smith. When you were talking to him, what was going through your mind? Were you finding out things about Milwaukee specifically that you never knew? What was your reaction to what he was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it was really like, you know, again, you don't have to, two Black men talking, you don't have to really explain to me that the cops and the Black community don't always have a good relationship. That's not the thing that I'm most compelled by. I know that. But the details of Milwaukee's specific history around that is what was interesting to me, because I'd lived in Chicago, I graduated high school in Chicago, so I'd been to Milwaukee a handful of times, but I didn't know anything about it. So for me, that's always interesting, too, to hear the specific history of a city and a place, and specifically in that episode as it relates to the Black community. So, you know, I think that was the thing I was really happy to have Reggie Jackson there for. I'm glad we got that interview. I just think the interview meant so much more because of the frame of the thing that happened with, I think they called her Halloween Helen. We're not having to prove to the audience, like, there's definitely a percentage of the audience who's watching the show who's like, I don't know, seems like Black people are always complaining about the cops. So for me, it was like, we don't have to push too hard to prove it because we walked up on it. Now, maybe you think we staged it. I can't really help you there. False flags, all that nonsense. But I know that this actually happened as we were coming here to talk to Reggie Jack.
And then also, you had the chance to speak with Maria Hamilton, Dontre Hamilton's mom. It was a different moment where you said this, but you were saying, for all the Black men who had been killed by police, you see yourselves in them. And so how was that, speaking with her?
I mean, I'm always feel very privileged to have that conversation, because she just certainly doesn't have to talk to me, and I certainly understand if she's told the story too much or feels like maybe she would be worried about what we would do with it, you know, or how, if you know, luckily the show's been on now that people are sort of familiar with the show when we call them, or they can get familiar pretty quickly. But, you know, I was felt lucky that she would sit down and talk to me, and she really opened up and told her story. And it's such a tragic story, and to be sitting in the place where it happened too was just so, it's not unbelievable because I believe it, but it's just so, it's like a gut punch to hear those stories and certainly be in the place where it's happening. So I was really honored that she would tell me the story. And then also sort of also saddened by the fact, and as I say in that segment, that it seems like we always have this thing where there's so many Black moms who have to step up in when their children, often sons, get killed by police and then sort of become professional activists, which I'm grateful to them and also sad for them, you know? So I felt like it's my job. I feel really happy to be able to uplift her story and to share it with the world, because there's been so many of these stories now that her story is not one of the more famous stories, which is sad to sort of have to rank them, but that's just the case. So I'm happy to be able to share her story. And she was really open, and we got up and walked around, and she showed me where Dontre had been killed, and was really like, you know, but also you could really feel her sadness. As it makes sense, she's still mourning. And then to talk with Sarita McFadden and say, when I see Black men killed by cops like Eric Garner, like I'm seeing myself. And that's an example of since I can't sit there and go, I've never heard of Black men being killed by cops like I would in another episode, opening myself up and being vulnerable like that felt really good to do in the show in a different way. And so, like, this is normally a conversation that I would have with Sarita, another Black person, and we would have this conversation, like, you know, that kind of a conversation, but it wouldn't be on camera. So I felt like I'm happy when I know the audience is seeing something they don't always see on TV.
And the fact that people do get to see these kind of intimate moments, what do you hope people, or what are you trying to get people to take away from this show, take away from the different people they get to see, the different areas you're going to?
I mean, I think there's two things. One, on a basic level, I just hope to change the conversation. The conversation you have after the show is different than the one you had coming in, because something in the show sort of sparks you to sort of think about things differently, or at least argue about things differently, you know, whether you put our case on or not. I just want the information to sort of affect you. And also, I wanted to be clear that all the problems that we've read, that we are sort of taught about in the history books for whatever they are, depending upon where we are in this country, are still the problems that America's dealing with. We're still dealing with white supremacy, we're dealing with patriarchy, we're dealing with racism on a daily basis, we're dealing with structural inequality and economic inequality, like all these things that we talk about in the history books in the so-called land of opportunity, the country's still dealing with, but some people are dealing with it in a more profound, oppressive way than others. And those people are people of color, obviously women. So, like, you know, I think that we have to really sort of, and then women of color even most of all. So I think we have to really sort of go, don't believe the hype that it's the land of opportunity. There's still problems we're dealing with and have to figure out. And so that stuff's not in the past. I think I'm trying to, the stuff you read in history books, like I say, America's not a series of dot and dashes. It's a line that keeps us, a continuous line.
W. Kamau Bell is a comedian and host of CNN's United Shades of America. The episode about Milwaukee, called #LivingWhileBlack, airs this Sunday night at 9 on CNN. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell.
A short break now, and then we'll revisit our interview with a Wisconsin writer whose book for young readers shares the story of a pivotal moment in the gay rights movement. Stay tuned. It's Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This is Pride Month nationally, and Milwaukee's Pride Fest is already underway, celebrating LGBTQ+ life. This year also marks a significant anniversary. 50 years ago this month, riots broke out at the site of New York City's Stonewall Inn.
The bar, with a mainly gay and lesbian clientele, was in the Greenwich Village section of Manhattan and was the site of a police raid. The riot that ensued is seen as a landmark moment in the history of the LGBTQ+ civil rights movement.
But while people coming of age today are very much aware of current events surrounding gay rights, notably the increasing acceptance and federal legality of same-sex marriage, Stonewall is still not a subject that gets a lot of ink in school history books. Wisconsin writer Ann Bossom's 2015 book fills that gap. It's called Stonewall: Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights, and she joined us 4 years ago to share the story. Welcome back to the show.
Very happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me start by asking about the creation of this book. What happened at a reading in South Dakota that sparked this book's beginning for you?
In 2010, actually, I was at a book signing, and it was a quiet moment, and someone came up to me very privately and said, looking at all of my books which deal with social justice history, and saying, can't you write something like this for young people about gay rights history? And I had already been thinking about that topic, but I had never had someone approach me, and her question was so heartfelt and clearly came with an untold story that added to my motivation. You know, maybe I really can and should do this. And that same weekend, I learned about the death of Tyler Clementi, the young man at Rutgers University who had the just atrocious cyberbullying incident that prompted him to jump from the George Washington Bridge. And the combination of those things, plus about a 5-year sort of, this would be a project for me to consider going on in my head. Those three things came together. It was like, that's it. No more Tylers. I'm going to write this book.
You also write that you had really wanted to write about Stonewall for a long time, even before that. So why was it so important for you to do that, even before South Dakota, even before Tyler's death?
Well, I've been writing for nearly 20 years now, and I seem to gravitate to the social justice theme. And it had become clear to me that we were really ignoring a tremendously important fight for social justice in this country by ignoring the fight for gay rights. And I began to wonder if I would be the right person to write that. I wondered if I would find a publisher who would publish it, if it was an even a feasible project to undertake.
Well, and in the end, I mean, you not only found a publisher, but you found a pretty major publisher.
I did. I am very fortunate to have collaborated with Viking on this. They have been extremely supportive from the moment I pitched the idea, and the book has turned out. You know, it's met my and exceeded my expectations.
Now, I think Stonewall, for many people, sits out there as a landmark moment in the history of gay rights. But for a lot of people, probably it kind of stops there. Like what people might know about the battles of Concord and Lexington or the Treaty of Versailles. You were not so old when the Stonewall riots happened. What did you know? And maybe more importantly, what didn't you know as you set out to write this book?
Well, I didn't know very much. I would have been about 10 when the Stonewall riots happened, 10 or 11. And I was living in Virginia at the time.
Probably not a lot of coverage.
No,
in the news
not a lot.
There.
Not a lot of coverage. Not a lot of coverage in New York City at the time. The homosexual community was so marginalized at that time that it wasn't really considered news that there was a gay riot in Greenwich Village. And so I lived in New York after college. I'm a graduate of Beloit College and lived in New York City and became familiar with the riots just as a general idea from living in New York. And I think had I been a member of the LGBT community, I would have been much more familiar with it because that is one of those touchstones of history that is the foundation of kind of the heritage that's passed on from one generation to the next. And I did not realize, for example, that the gay pride parades, which occur around the globe now in late June of every year, were originally established as a tribute to the Stonewall riots. And that's very well known within the gay community. And I'm really glad that I've been able to try to bring that history out into the open for all of us to appreciate. It's a fantastic story.
Well, and there is a lot that's kind of more subtle about what actually took place on that, you know, overnight between June 27th and 28, 1969, that people are probably not aware of. For example, I had no idea that there was an angle of this that involved the mafia.
No, nor did I. When I started the research, I had the impression that there was a raid at a gay bar, that it was one raid too many, and the riots that followed were triggered by this straightforward raid. And that was not the case at all. And I think most people have that misconception that this was just a gay bar raid that set off a spark that triggered riots. In fact, by the time of the riots in mid-1969, running a gay bar was not illegal. In New York City, going to a gay bar was not illegal. Dancing at a gay bar was not illegal.
All and these things had been illegal a couple of years
these
before.
These things had been illegal. They were in this gray area at the time when the Stonewall was opened in 1967. And the mafia was getting into the gay bar business at that time because since it was illegal, it created this opportunity for exploitation and moneymaking. And there was a wink and nod system that evolved with the police that allowed these bars to open and stay open through a payoff system. And that heritage was evolving by the time of the Stonewall riots. And the mafia still ran these bars, and they weren't necessarily illegal, but illegal behavior was going on at them. And this was a time when it was still very common to be in the closet because there was not legal protection that could keep you from losing your job, et cetera.
Right. The existence of a gay bar wasn't illegal and dancing at a gay bar wasn't illegal, but you could still easily be fired from your job.
Right. Being gay could get you in all kinds of trouble. And so this was being exploited at these mafia-run gay bars in Greenwich Village, and people were being blackmailed. And the police had become aware of this, and so these bars were being targeted by the police in an effort to try to stop this blackmailing. And the thought was to try to put the Stonewall out of business, not because it was doing the blackmailing, because that can be hard to prove, but because it had a kind of a sketchy liquor license. And it had set itself up in 1967 under this sort of sketchy legal code because it was trying to skirt under these laws that where it was still kind of a gray area, were they opening a legal business or not.
But at the same time, so the idea was they would try to shut the Stonewall Inn down under the pretense that they were trying to deal with these sketchy liquor laws or the sketchy liquor business they were in. And at the same time, if closing it down meant that the blackmail would go away, then that—
Exactly. So it was kind of a roundabout way to shut down the blackmailing. And oh, by the way, the bar's going to end up being closed too.
But this distinction does not necessarily matter at all to the regular patrons of the Stonewall.
No, they're just ticked off. And they're old enough to have witnessed plenty of police raids and to have thought they were done. And one other thing that's often not known about the history is that this wasn't the first time the Stonewall had been raided by this operation. That had happened just a few days earlier. And so many of the people who were there Friday night had already witnessed a police raid on Tuesday night. And in contrast to the earlier raid, this one occurred after midnight on a Friday night under a full moon on a very hot evening, and all catalysts, potential catalysts for trouble.
You went through a lot of different historical information about what had taken place that night. And what's interesting is there are seemingly a ton of archives of writings from people who were either there when the raids began or people who gravitated toward the raid, towards the raid and the riots that ensued afterwards. What were the remarkable threads you found as you started examining these contemporary writings and perhaps speaking with people who were there that night?
I think that the threads that emerged from the historical record were almost uniformly full of rage. And just this fed-upness and this crystallizing moment came together right then, right there, and all of the factors fed into an uprising.
Were there particular challenges you ran into in writing about Stonewall for a younger audience?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a publisher who believed in the project and believed in telling the history unchecked. And my target audience is the teenage reader. I think we live in a world where they're encountering pretty sophisticated material, and I didn't feel constrained in being able to talk about this history in a straightforward and honest way.
And of course, the book does come along as gay rights are very much a regular part of the news and a regular part of the landscape.
Absolutely. The book seems to be coming out at just the time when the readership might most want and appreciate the chance to learn this backstory to the current gay rights movement.
Well, and it's worth noting that the book does not end with the end of the Stonewall riots and their immediate aftermath. You do kind of go into some of the landmarks along the way for both gay rights and issues that the gay community faces in the years and the decades since.
Yeah, I felt that was very important. You know, we always try to simplify our history, and there's been an oversimplification about Stonewall that says, you know, this was the spark that started the gay rights movement. And that's not really true. There had been a movement for decades before that, and the movement would have continued without it. But Stonewall certainly was a catalyzing moment in turning what was a relatively small movement into a much larger one. But just as young people today aren't going to know about Stonewall, they're also not going to know about what happened in the three decades, four decades since. And I felt it was important to give that preview of what had come before and a sense of what had come after so that I really could bring the readers up to current times and also use the gay rights movement to illustrate the same ups and downs that every social justice movement has. It wasn't just this wonderful arc from Stonewall to marriage equality. There were a vast array of challenges along the way.
Right. I mean, it just the same way that it might be tempting to imagine the civil rights movement as everything up to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech to all of a sudden things have changed. Stonewall is this big moment in 1969. I mean, you know, this is 45 years before marriage equality becomes a more common occurrence in this country.
Exactly. I always err on the side of giving the full context. And I think it makes the read that much more exciting, actually, because there really is this amazing arc of trial and tribulation and perseverance that helps you appreciate why the movement has been as successful as it has in recent years.
There is an audio version of this book, and that has not necessarily always happened with your books.
No, it's I've been very lucky this time because not only is there an audiobook, but it is a fantastic production from Listening Library, narrated by Tim Federle, who is an award-winning author and narrator. And this audio production has already gotten an Earphones Award from Audiophile. You know, I actually have the text pretty much memorized. That's true of any author by the time they get to a published book. But I put in Tim's audiobook and I couldn't turn it off. He just pulled me right in. I wanted to hear his voice all the way through to the final words.
Would you hope that the woman who spoke with you in South Dakota knows about this book?
Oh, I certainly hope so. And actually, when the South Dakota Book Festival heard about the book, they've invited me to come back to talk about it this fall in South Dakota. And that would truly complete the circle to be able to see this woman again. I would treasure that moment.
Well, Ann Bossum, it's great stuff. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Mitch.
Wisconsin writer Ann Bossum is the author of numerous books, including her 2015 book for young readers called Stonewall, Breaking Out in the Fight for Gay Rights. It was published by Viking. There's an audiobook as well, and you'll find a link to more about her and about Stonewall at WUWM.com.
Our sports contributor looks back at the first third of the baseball season and ahead to Packers training camp later this summer. That comes your way when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We are not quite halfway through the Major League Baseball season, but the Milwaukee Brewers are hanging around the top spot in the National League Central Division, chasing their arch rivals, the Chicago Cubs.
Expectations were high for the Brewers this season, months after they came within a game of advancing to the World Series for the first time since 1982. Sean Ranft is our sports contributor, and he is here with us to talk about the Brewers and then another Milwaukee team that was thwarted just short of making it to its championship series. Welcome back, Sean. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me back again.
So let's start with baseball.
Okay.
We're into June, and the Brewers have not been a runaway, you know, a world beater this year. On the other hand, they haven't been awful.
No, they're hanging right in there. They recently overtook first for about 48 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Before the Marlins came to town.
Before
the Marlins came to town. We have to emphasize that.
As we're having this conversation, I think they're about to play the last of their games against the Marlins in
yes,
this series.
And
so who knows how it will come out.
And they've lost the first two by a combined 24-3.
Which is not what you expect from either the Brewers or the Marlins.
No. You know, every once in a while you're going to get that fluke game and, you know, 16 to nothing game, and a team's going to score 11 runs in one inning, and there's nothing you can do about it. You burn the footage, you move on. And then it happens again the next day, and then you don't worry, though. They're still right there in the division. The Cardinals have been struggling a bit. The Cubs were struggling the last couple weeks, but they're picking it up now. And they just signed closer Craig Kimbrell. And I just want to, as an aside, say every team is dumb for not signing him earlier. And now
this is the guy, for people who are not familiar with Craig Kimbrell, he was the Red Sox closer for a few years. Before that, he was the lights-out closer for the Atlanta Braves.
Yes, and he literally just won a World Series ring with the Red Sox last season. And he's still only in his early 30s.
Well, and so why were teams reluctant to jump on the Craig Kimbrell bandwagon when he was clearly the best closer who was on the market? There are a lot of teams who have been doing closer by committee this
year. Yeah, and obviously, at least with Kimbrell, he wanted a huge contract. He wanted 6 years and, you know, a little north of $100 million. And teams don't want to pay that for almost anybody right now. Teams are especially hesitant when it comes to relief pitchers because those can change on a yearly basis or injuries can happen. Look at the Brewers with Knebel. Jeffers was injured before the season started. and he's come back fine. Josh Hader has been a little more hittable this season, even though he just picked up the Reliever of the Month award. When he gets hit, it's a home run lately, and that wasn't happening last season. And the Brewers went out and kind of shored up some odd ends in the bullpen, but Craig Kimbrell was right there. That's a future Hall of Famer and currently still one of the best relievers in the game. And yeah, teams just didn't want to pay him that much money, and now the Cubs got him for 3 years at under $50 million. That's a sweet deal for one of the best closers of all time. And every team is dumb for A, not signing him earlier, and now B, letting the Cubs just swoop in and grab him.
And if you're a Brewers fan, that especially smarts.
Especially if you're a Brewers fan. And I saw a note yesterday, his career ERA against the rest of the Central Division is just over one. So, you know, it's going to be fun. Next few years is going to be fun when you have to come back against the Cubs, which is already tough to do. Their bullpen was the one weakness. When their lineup's healthy, they're great. But let's stop talking about the Cubs.
Let's talk about the Brewers.
Let's talk about the Brewers.
The Brewers did pick up somebody that everybody else had passed on, and they got kind of a bargain in the offseason, and he's kind of paid some dividends, Yasmani Grandal.
Yes. There is no such thing as a bad one-year deal. I know a few people were a little hesitant when it was for a little over $18 million. Like Kimbrel, Grandal was the best at his position this
past
season. He's a catcher. But signing Grandal was a no-brainer for teams that you thought were trying to contend. And then when he landed on the Brewers, he landed in their lap, and I couldn't believe it. And then they brought back Mike Moustakas on another one-year deal. He's got like a mutual option in there.
And these are the kinds of deals that I think longtime Brewers fans have to still be kind of shaking their head in a I can't believe we're doing this sort of way. These are the kinds of deals that the Brewers never used to make.
No, and it started with last offseason with the biggest contract in team history to Lorenzo Cain. Yeah, those are things that just don't happen with Milwaukee, but they had their farm system set up enough where they were able to trade for Christian Yelich, and then they were able to sign Cain. And then this past offseason, they ended up walking away with Moustakas and Grandal anyway. And I still think they could have done more. Kimbrel was there. Dallas Keuchel is still out there, a starting pitcher. They ended up bringing Gio Gonzalez back because the Yankees didn't think he was, you know, good enough to be on their main roster. And he's been steady. And I thought they could have looked into bringing Wade Miley back for cheaper. But I don't think anyone expected all three of their young pitchers that they were going to rely on at the beginning of the season, Corbin Burns, Freddy Peralta, and Brandon Woodruff, to struggle so mightily. So
one has to imagine, though, that for the Brewers to still be within a game or two of first place in the NL Central actually speaks pretty highly of them, because this is a team that still could improve quite a bit over the second
half. Oh, yes, and they're still a good team. I don't want it to sound like I think they're a bad team. The Brewers are still fine. It's not going to be a runaway by any team in this division, even the Cubs, with as talented as they are. I know we tend to overreact, especially with baseball, because, you know, the good stretches, they last for a couple of weeks, and then it feels like the bad stretches last for a month. But there's going to be ups and downs in every sport season, but this season is 162 games long, so there's going to be considerably more.
All right, so let's shift briefly to basketball and do a quick postmortem on the Bucks season. This is a team, it's interesting, you talk about patience that fan bases have with their teams, and this is a team that was the best team. They were the class of the NBA over the course of the 82-game season.
Yes.
And really, they came within, you know, just spitting distance of making it to the NBA final. So by all accounts, Bucks fans should be pretty happy with how this season turned out. To read in the national media, though, everyone is saying, well, the Bucks really need to do some soul searching in this offseason. Where do you fall in this continuum? Do the Bucks have any major questions that they have to answer?
I think they have one or two, but I don't think I'd call them major questions. They have a lot of decisions they need to make regarding pending free agency. Brook Lopez, having him back would be wonderful, but a team is going to offer him way more money than he got this past season. They have to make a decision on Malcolm Brogdon, who is a restricted free agent. Someone is going to want to sign him to a near-max level contract. He does a little bit of everything. and they're going to have to decide, because I don't think they'll be able to re-sign everybody. And that's where the difficulty comes in.
They need another star? I mean, some of the pundits are saying, you know, they need another, you know, legitimate star to go along with Giannis.
I don't think so. I think even Malcolm Brogdon could be that star. And again, this is a team that won the most games out of anyone in the regular season, and they went up 2-0 on the Toronto Raptors, who won the second most games of anyone in the regular season. But people seem to forget that the Toronto Raptors, as we're currently seeing now, are really good. They're extremely good defensively, and it helped that in the Eastern Conference Finals, a lot of their players stepped up. A lot of them that you didn't expect shot lights out. And in the Bucks case, that didn't happen after game two. Everyone kind of forgot how to shoot. And yeah, you know, everyone was saying, oh, Giannis could have done a little bit more, which I'm going to laugh at because he did everything right all season. You need a little bit of help in the playoffs. And they did an excellent job of slowing him down, though, especially after game two. No one else stepped up. Chris Middleton had a huge game four. They lost by 20 points. And Mirotić forgot how to shoot three-pointers. Yeah. He shot under 20% for the playoffs. Eric Bledsoe disappeared. Malcolm Brogdon was good, but
he'd been injured for the last couple of months.
Yeah. No one else stepped up. Brook Lopez had a big game one, disappeared after that. So I don't think they need another star because their team was excellent this past season. Their bench was excellent this past season, and then they got to game three of the Eastern Conference Finals, and they all seemingly forgot how to play basketball as a team. Everything they had done together, they weren't doing after that. Maybe Mike Budenholzer was a little bit stubborn, and he should have made some adjustments, and he's notorious for not making adjustments in the playoffs, and that's basically the only criticism he gets. But I don't think there's a second star out there that they'll be able to afford without losing a couple of the guys that they have now. Brook Lopez could be gone. Middleton could be gone. Brogdon could be gone. Those are the decisions they have to make. I don't think they have to do any of this soul searching. I don't think the season was a failure, obviously. If you'd have told most Bucks fans, and especially most Bucks fans I know, at the beginning of the season or even at the end of last season that, hey, they're going to be two games away from the NBA Finals, what do you think the response would be? I'm pretty sure most would be very happy about it. And the only thing I'll add to that, though, is that it's really crummy how abruptly it ended. Again, they were off to a 2-0 lead, and you thought, oh, my goodness, this is happening. And then they lost four straight. They hadn't lost three straight all season. So to see them lose four straight, one of them being at home where they were almost unbeatable all season, it sucks. But it wasn't a failure of a season. They don't have to tear anything down. You know, they have a new arena. Everyone's excited about the new arena. Giannis is arguably the best player in basketball, or the potentially the best player in basketball. So they're going to be fine. They just have to make a decision between a couple of their guards and how much money they're willing to spend to keep them. Okay. If they lose them all, then there's a problem, but I don't think they're going to lose them all.
All right, so from a team that that definitely did not have a failure of a season to a team that, if it wasn't a failure of a season, it was a pretty close replica of one. The Packers, as we know, finished last year 6-9-1.
Yes.
And I don't know that there was anybody associated with that team that took anything positive out of that season. We're obviously well before full training camp gets underway here, but what's your thought about the way the Packers have been reshaping themselves in the offseason?
They almost can't be worse than the stretches they went through last season. The biggest thing, and this is becoming more and more of a question every season, is the health of Aaron Rodgers.
As opposed to the health of their new head coach.
As opposed to the health of Matt LaFleur, who tore his ACL in OTAs, because apparently that happens now. He likes to be very hands-on, so I guess he hurt himself during a drill. But yeah, Aaron Rodgers has been not 100% the last couple seasons, whether it's his shoulder and he plays through it, or he takes a month off and he comes back a little early, or last season with his knee in the first game of the season, and he wasn't 100% all year either, but you can't keep using that as an excuse. The Green Bay Packers have a pretty good team, and at the end of the day, they still have Aaron Rodgers. they should be better than 6-9-1. You expect them to be contending every single season. I don't think you can call them Super Bowl contenders every single season, but they should be battling for the division title every year until Rodgers, that is no longer there. It'll be interesting. You said anyone associated with the team probably couldn't take any positives. I agree with that. I know a handful of fans who were probably very happy to see Mike McCarthy go, but in the aftermath of that, you had a lot of he said reports of him and Aaron Rodgers right. never got along, Aaron Rodgers didn't think highly of Mike McCarthy, all of that. Hopefully none of that will be a distraction once preseason comes and they can just focus on playing.
And finally, the nice sounding thing that's coming out of the offseason is that it sounds like the Packers are going to sign Jordy Nelson to a 1-day contract to let him retire.
Yes,
as
and that's a nice thing and a deserved thing. I know 1-day contracts happen all the time for that very reason. I know people were very upset when they released him and he went to the Raiders. I still maintain that was the right decision as a team to make. But yeah, it's going to be nice to see Jordy back. He is one of the at least of my lifetime, one of the better receivers in Packers history.
A lot of people with 87 jerseys there are going to be pleased.
Him and Aaron Rodgers had a great rapport. It was like Freeman and Favre, or anyone in Favre, when Favre was in his prime in Green Bay. Nothing but touchdowns. They loved each other. They understood each other. And I'm pretty sure Aaron Rodgers wishes he had another one like that. But yeah, seeing Jordy back in Green Bay and him getting that special moment, he deserves that moment. Green Bay fans deserve that moment too, so that'll be nice.
Sean Ranft, it's been great talking with you over the years. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back.
Sean Ranft is Lake Effect's regular sports contributor. You can hear Pat's conversations with him at WUWM.com.
There is lots to do in Milwaukee in the summer besides watching the Brewers. Milwaukee Magazine's Carol Nixon joins us in just a moment to preview the magazine's summer guide issue when we return with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie Norris.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Now that summer seems to be here, more or less, it's time to get out and explore what the city has to offer. And there is a lot to see and do.
Every year, Milwaukee Magazine publishes its City Guide issue to help you plot your best course of action. Carol Nixon is the magazine's publisher, and she joins us now to preview the issue. How are you?
I'm doing well, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm great. And, you know, it's June, and I keep thinking it should be just a touch warmer,
but I'm still
happy it's warmer than it has been. And it's a perfect time to pick up your City Guide issue.
This is my fourth City Guide. I've been at the magazine that long now. And, you know, it's one of those things we do every year, but it's a challenge to reinvent it. But the fortunate thing is that there is so much to do in Milwaukee in the summer that we always find new things.
And so I understand there are 14 sections.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do them in order, of course, but because there are 14 weekends in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
What do we want to start with?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm very fond of unplugging. Being of a generation that did not grow up with social media and everything, I think I find it a little easier to unplug than some people. But I think this was a really ingenious way of approaching some activities. So our writer, Adam Rogan, suggests different things that you can do instead of doing something else. For instance, instead of scrolling through Instagram for another hour, take a walk through Black Cat Alley. And to make it even better, well, you get to see all the murals and the art in Black Cat Alley, but you can also sneak into the speakeasy called Shanghai that's just nearby at Crossroads. So you can have a drink, too.
That's a lot of fun. And that's on the lower Upper East Side.
Yes.
It's just south of North Avenue. And Colectivos are on the one side and the Orientals are on the other
side. Exactly.
And it's a wonderful. I just walked through it the other day, and there's always something new and different
going on up there. It's really inspiring. So that one, there's about seven different activities, and they're all analog, if you will, and I just think it's really fun.
Well, and then right next to it is one of my favorite things to do in the summer, which is sweat it out. I like to be on my bike. I just did the UPath ride. That was great. You know, I run, I do duathlons. And so all of these wonderful suggestions here from Lindsay, who's come and talked to me about art things before, there's some terrific ideas here.
That one's really fun. So that page is set up as a flow chart, and you get to just, you know, work your way through it. So you start with how fit are you? And the choices are I could bench press the bronze fawns or I'm as soft as a cream puff. And from there, you can go on to find what your suitable activity is. And it might be a 5K at a traveling beer garden, volleyball at Bradford Beach, surfing at Atwater if you're really, really fit and adventurous. Or if you, you know, are taking a little more laid-back approach, maybe a kayak ride around McKinley Marina or doing a bike ride at your own pace on the Oak Leaf Trail.
And because it's Milwaukee, I do love the idea that you do a 5K at a traveling beer garden.
Of course.
Because you need to rehydrate.
Yes. Once again,
it's,
you know,
there
should be a cocktail component to pretty much any activity in the summertime.
In the summertime here. There's also a page that makes the case for a staycation.
Oh, well, that's another really great page, I think. It's a weekend, and you know, there's so many new things going on always in Milwaukee in the summertime. So the staycation, you would stay at the St. Kate's, which is just opening this week. And that in and of itself, I think you could just stay within the hotel and between the new branch of the Wisconsin Art Museum and all the things, the champagne bar, everything that they have going on, could probably just stay there. But no, we have other activities for you to do while you're staying there, including going to Grant Park and renting a cabana, which I have not done, but it sounds wonderful.
I haven't done that either.
I know. If it only get warm, we would do it, Bonnie. We would go.
We would. All right. And so we go to Grant Park, we do that, and then we can also...
Well, one of my favorites is this new thing, retro boat rides. So you can book 2-hour boat rides and they're in these old speed boats. And yeah, I want to do that right here on the river.
That sounds fantastic. And of course, there would not be a summer activity. I mean, shopping has to be involved.
Shopping has to be. It's city guide, you know, and we have to guide you on your shopping. And sooner or later, it is going to rain on a Saturday and you're going to want to do something. So Jenna Cashew put together this amazing little guide of everything from designer boutiques to specialty toy stores to where to find vinyl records, et cetera. It's hats, like his and her hat shops. One is the Brass Rooster for men and the other is the Hen House for women. And I don't know. I haven't bought a hat in a long time. How about
you? Might have to. You might have to go down there.
I know.
Yeah, the Brass Rooster folks are great. And and they have wonderful, wonderful hats. Well, so that's a terrific thing. And another page, I just opened it up randomly here, and I've got two very, very different things. One is root for the home team.
Yeah, so, you know, this summer, for the first time, we have two home teams. We've got the Brewers and the Milkmen. The Milkmen, you know, I'm not super sporty, but it's not quite in the same category as the Brewers.
It's like not the same league.
Exactly. Yeah. Not the same league. But the Milkmen are new and they have a new stadium that's being built, not quite finished yet. And so we do a little bit of a comparison of what you can expect. And you know, the Brewers are great and I love them and I love going to see them. But the Milkmen are a bargain. And if you're taking the whole family, you might want to check it out.
It's a different league of play as well.
Yes.
And so it's probably you're a lot closer to the field and you have a lot more opportunity to interact with the players.
I would think so,
and that sort of thing. It's like the AA and AAA leagues.
I thought one thing that was telling is that we compare the salaries. And, of course, the range for the Brewers starts around $500,000 a year, whereas the Milkmen, they get about $1,600 a month. So it's different.
Yeah, very, very different feel. Well, and right next to that is Take a Walk on the Wild Side. And there's a beautiful fox family that's sitting there.
Oh, I know.
But that is something that I think people who don't live here or just visiting or recently moved here don't realize that there's so much wildlife right within the city.
Oh, yeah. So that piece, you know, we incorporated a few I wouldn't call them long reads. They're about 400 words, but just little passages that are more of a reading experience. And this one is written by Ken Leinbach, who's the director of the Urban Ecology Center. And it's about where he finds nature in the city. And he likes to go to Estabrook. And he also likes to watch the birds, which, you know, you could kind of see anywhere if you just are observant. But myself, 2 weekends ago, I walked through the Urban Ecology Center, the path along the river, and it was so lovely. And the frogs were croaking, and a stranger stopped me and said, you know, listen. And so we stopped and listened together, and it was really sweet. It was great.
Yeah, this morning as I was getting ready to come to work, I had all the windows open, and all of a sudden it sounded like an entire flock of geese was going to land in my living room because they were flying over the house. Uh-huh. And we see geese all the time, and we don't think, but that's nature literally overhead.
Oh, yeah. It's true. It's true. It's exciting.
And the one I want to wrap up with is one that I confess, these were things I didn't know at all about, and I've been here 13 years now, the Lesser Known Fests page.
Yes.
And there are four of them that Matt lists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, actually, five. You count the longer piece he wrote. The longer piece is about Garlic Fest, and, you know, there's just a lot of garlic, everything at Garlic Fest. It's garlic ice cream, garlic, savory foods.
Cotton candy.
Cotton,
oh, my goodness.
Candy, yes. So, and that one is June 23rd, and that's in Walker's Point. But then one that I'm excited about is Crusher Fest. So do you know about the Crusher?
I do.
So the Crusher, as you know, was a famous wrestler. And I know him mostly because I used to be a big fan of the rock band The Cramps, and they did a song about the Crusher. But there are other songs about the Crusher because that's how beloved he was and is. So that's coming up June 8 and 9. That's this weekend in downtown South Milwaukee, the Crusher Fest. And then we've got Port Fish Day in Port Washington, Hip Hop Week in August around town at various locations, and Pet Fest. And that one pushes us all the way into September. That was a little bit of an outlier, but, you know, we had to stick it in there anyway. And that's at Henry Meyer Park.
I love it. And, you know, being a pet person, I think that's going to be a fun one. And, you know, September usually is warm. It kind of extends summer a little bit. So we forgive you.
Okay, thank you.
We forgive
you. Thank you.
So, well, Carol, I think you've given us more than enough due for well beyond the summer. But I look forward to talking to you again on other things. But thank you so much for the City Guide and for coming
in. Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be here, as always. Ray! Do the hammer lock.
Carol Nixon is editor and publisher of Milwaukee Magazine. The magazine's Summer City Guide issue is available right this very second. That is today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch, Joy Powers, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week. We get help from Ben Benversi, Zoe Munson, Cassidy Schrader, and Allison Dukanovich.
We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Chuck Kornbach, Susan Bentz, Angelina Mosher-Salazar, and Taryn Powell this week.
Lauren Sickveson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.